Hello, this is Tom Clammer, and what follows is the podcast of the Christmas Day 2014 edition of Tell Somebody, which starts out with law professor Marjorie Cohn returning to the show to talk about the grand jury process in the Ferguson, Missouri case. I had to take out some wonderful music from the broadcast edition due to copyright rules, but I have included a lot of additional audio of George Walker and Kathy Kelly speaking in Kansas City on December 9th, the night before their convictions and sentencing in federal court in Jefferson City, Missouri on December 10th for protesting drone warfare at Whiteman Air Force Base. Walker was sentenced to 1 year of supervised probation and Kelly to a 3-month sentence in federal prison. There's more information on previous podcasts of Tell Somebody at tellsomebody.us, at peaceworkskc.org, and at the Voices for Creative Nonviolence website, www.vcnv.org. And more information on Marjorie Cohn at marjoriecohn.com. These podcasts are produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the show broadcast on Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. on KKFI in Kansas City. Give a listen.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
Today on Tell Somebody, law professor Marjorie Cohn returns to the show to discuss the grand jury process. And there came wise men from the east, and when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And when they were departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeareth to Joseph in a dream, saying, Arise, and take the young child and his mother, and flee this country, and be thou there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night, and departed to leave the country, traveling through the desert. And after they crossed the border, they were met by vigilantes, who searched for bottles of water left by good Samaritans for thirsty pilgrims, and the vigilantes wanted to destroy the water to discourage the pilgrims. And the vigilantes delivered Joseph and Mary and the young child to the border patrol. And the border patrol said unto Joseph, Where is thine visa and thine green card? And Joseph had none. So the border patrol said unto Joseph, Hark, thou art illegal immigrants. And they delivered Joseph and Mary and the young child unto the private detention corporation, where they waited many days to be turned out in a bad part of town on the other side of the border. And the border patrol returned unto their office holiday party. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Merry Christmas and welcome to Tell Somebody for December 25th, 2014, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now. Look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook, And remember, you can subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes Store. This is your host, Tom Clamer. The podcast of last week's show with Kathy Kelly speaking on drone warfare and Ray McGovern talking about his confrontation with torture supporter Pete Hoekstra has been posted. Go to tellsomebody.us and click on the upper left tile with Kathy Kelly's picture to read more about all this and to link to the audio file. I got an email on Tuesday with a press release from Veterans for Peace headlined, "Veterans for Peace Appalled at the Murder of Brooklyn Police Officers." I want to read part of that release right now. Veterans for Peace joins with millions of people across the United States who stand shocked and appalled at the murder of NYPD officers Rafael Ramos and Wenxian Liu in Brooklyn. We join with the loved ones of these innocent police officers in mourning their deaths. Two more seats will be empty at tables this holiday season due to unnecessary violence. The national movement, sparked by the people of Ferguson, Missouri, for racial justice and police accountability, should and must continue. Blaming the killing of these officers on people exercising their constitutional rights to press for reform of an abusive system is misleading and irresponsible. It reminds us of those who say that we should not protest unjust U.S. wars or hold anyone accountable for torture because to do so aids and abets the enemy. Both narratives seek to maintain the existing state of affairs and ignore the countless peaceful protesters across the nation calling for peace and justice and an end to all state-sanctioned violence. You can see the entire release at www.veteransforpeace.org. Marjorie Cohn was on the show 3 weeks ago to talk about the new book she edited on issues related to drone warfare. About at that time, she also wrote a piece headlined, "Prosecutor Manipulates Grand Jury Process to Shield Officer," in connection to the Ferguson, Missouri situation, and I wanted to get her back on the show to talk about that. Marjorie Cohn is a professor of criminal law and process at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, and is a criminal defense attorney. Among many other books she has authored or edited, she is co-author of Cameras in the Courtroom, Television and the Pursuit of Justice. Give a listen now to Professor Marjorie Cohn, recorded shortly before the murders in Brooklyn. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
My pleasure, Tom.
3 or so weeks ago, you wrote a piece that I think it was on Truthout and maybe Huffington Post, a couple places. Prosecutor manipulates grand jury process to shield officer. And, of course, this was in reference to the Ferguson situation. What made you write this?
Well, when the grand jury in Ferguson declined to indict Officer Darren Wilson in the shooting of the 18-year-old African-American Michael Brown, there was a lot of publicity about it, and the grand jury transcript was made public, and a number of things struck me that people should know about. First of all, the purpose of a grand jury is not to decide whether somebody is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It is to decide whether there's probable cause to believe that somebody committed a crime, and then if the grand jury comes back with an indictment saying, yes, there's probable cause, then it goes to a jury trial. The grand jury proceeding it's a secret proceeding. Only the prosecutor and the grand jurors are there. There's no defense attorney, and there's no cross-examination by a defense attorney. So, for example, I've handled a number of cases where I had to sit outside the grand jury room because I was not allowed into the grand jury room. So usually what happens in nearly every case is that the prosecutor goes to the grand jury, presents a bare-bones case enough to show probable cause, and asks the grand jury to indict, and the grand jury does indict in nearly every case. And in fact, the Ferguson grand jury had been sitting on cases since May. So they knew that what happened in case after case is that just that, that the prosecutor would come in, present a bare-bones case, say, there is probable cause to believe that this person committed A, B, and C crimes, and the grand jury would comply with an indictment. This case, the Michael Brown, Darren Wilson case, was treated very, very differently, and the grand jury could tell that this was treated very differently. First of all, the prosecutor put on 3 months of testimony and evidence, not just a bare-bones case. And also, the transcripts show that the prosecutor and his assistants asked leading questions of the officer and softball questions, and yet when there were witnesses that contradicted the officer's testimony, they were put through the ringer. One of the prosecutors, just before Officer Wilson testified, one of the prosecutors handed a copy of an old Missouri statute to the grand jurors to set the context for Officer Wilson's testimony, and that statute had been overruled by the Supreme Court, and according to that statute, it was a very low bar for an officer to prove self-defense. So he didn't even have to prove that he felt threatened, basically, in any significant way, certainly not probable cause. And it wasn't several weeks later, that the prosecutor told the grand jury, well, that statute doesn't comply with the Supreme Court jurisprudence, so ignore it. And one of the grand jurors asked the prosecutor, what takes precedence, the Missouri statute or the Supreme Court? And the prosecutor said, you don't need to worry about that. So that was kind of left hanging, plus the fact that the prosecutor didn't actually ask the grand jury to issue an indictment. And that's really the key thing, the key difference between this case and all of the other cases that grand jury had presumably sat on. The prosecutor just gave the grand jury all of this evidence and said, do what you will with it, after really structuring the case in the light most favorable to the officer. And what really should have happened here is that it should have gone to a jury trial. There should have been an indictment, which doesn't say he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It just says there's probable cause to believe he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And then let the jury decide with cross-examination who to believe, whether or not the officer was acting in lawful self-defense.
What about some people have raised the issue of prosecutorial discretion, and maybe this grand jury thing was a dodge to not have to directly make that decision himself, but the prosecutor in cases in general either believes or doesn't believe that a crime that needs to be prosecuted has been committed, and if he didn't believe that was the case in the Officer Wilson situation, does he have to aggressively try to get him put on trial if he doesn't believe it?
Well, it's a good point. Prosecutors rarely believe that officers are at fault. The officers and the prosecutors are have a very close relationship. The police department acts kind of as an investigative arm of the prosecutor. Prosecutors don't like to anger police officers, and so the prosecutors look at these police shootings through the lens of not really believing that officers do any harm. And I think you're right in terms of the dodge, because there are two different ways that a case can get to trial. One is through a grand jury indictment in secret, which we've talked about, and the other is through an open and public preliminary hearing where a prosecutor files charges and then the defendant goes before a judge in an open public hearing. With cross-examination, both sides can present witnesses, and then the judge decides whether there's probable cause to send him to trial. In this case, the prosecutor went into the secret grand jury and basically passed the buck to the grand jury, saying, I'm not going to tell you to indict or not to indict. You do what you want. And so the grand jury is left holding the bag, or the responsibility, I guess you might say. And the prosecutor can say, well, I presented all the evidence to the grand jury. You know, what else could I have done? But in the way that this whole thing was structured, it was clearly the prosecutor manipulating the grand jury into refusing to return an indictment against Officer Wilson.
In your piece, you quoted the writing of Supreme Court Justice Scalia on grand juries, I believe in something that came up over 10, 20 years ago or something. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Yes, Justice Scalia explained the function of the grand jury in the case of United States versus Williams. And Scalia wrote, quote, it is the grand jury's function not to inquire upon what foundation the charge may be denied or otherwise to try the suspect's defenses, but only to examine upon what foundation the charge is made by the prosecutor. As a consequence, neither in this country nor in England has the suspect under investigation by the grand jury ever been thought to have a right to testify or to have exculpatory evidence presented. That means exonerating evidence. Well, every principle that Scalia cited was violated in the Ferguson case. First, the grand jury was asked to determine whether Wilson acted in self-defense. Second, Wilson was allowed to give 4 hours of self-serving testimony with no cross-examination to the grand jury. And for 3 months, prosecutors presented both incriminating and exculpatory evidence. Exculpatory means exonerating the officer. So every principle was violated. And another thing I want to say, another reason, well, I guess the main reason that this should have gone to a trial, is that the crux of the officer's self-defense claim was that Michael Brown was charging at him when the officer fired the fatal shots into the top of Michael Brown's bowed head. And that was critical to whether or not the officer acted reasonably in his use of deadly force. Reasonableness of use of deadly force is key to a self-defense. There were witnesses who testified on both sides, and the two witnesses who supported the officer's testimony, we don't know their names, well, we do actually know one of their names, witnesses 40 and 10, witness number 40, witness number 10. Now, witness number 40, it turns out, and it's come out on the Smoking Gun website. She is a woman who is bipolar. She has a criminal record. She has a history of making racist comments. She once actually got herself involved in another high-profile St. Louis criminal case. The police eventually said that she was lying and didn't use her testimony. Her name is Sandra McElroy, and she may have lied about witnessing the shooting of Michael Brown. Now, she was a very active commentator on the Brown case. She had a couple of Facebook accounts constantly commenting about the case, supportive of Officer Wilson. She posted a photograph of Michael Brown lying dead in the street and with a caption that said something like, stop asking for justice for Michael Brown, he got his justice. And she was constantly writing, pray for Officer Wilson. She had two journal entries in her journal. One said, well, I'm going to take my random drive to Florissant. I need to understand the black race so I can stop calling blacks the N-word. And then another entry, she described Michael Brown as charging at Officer Wilson before Wilson shot him. And this is the key. She said, the cop just stood there. Dang if that kid didn't start running right at the cop like a football player head down. Now, it took her 5 weeks to come forward with her account, and she didn't come. Law enforcement didn't find her. She found them. more than a month after the incident. Nobody really probably attempted to determine whether what she said was true, and they could have done that with some simple checking. Now, the other witness who supported the officer's testimony was witness number 10, who testified to the grand jury, and he changed his story about where Michael Brown was walking. He was probably the most important witness to appear in the officer's defense. And this is what witness number 10 said. Michael Brown stopped. He did turn. He did some sort of body gesture. I'm not sure what it was, but I know it was a body gesture. And I could say for sure he never put his hands up. After he did his body gesture, he ran towards the officer full charge. So the question is, were Michael Brown's hands up, and many witnesses said they were, which is kind of surrendering posture, or was he charging at the officer, which would have made it reasonable for the officer to shoot him in self-defense? So when the prosecutor asked witness number 10 to describe what he called a body gesture, witness number 10 said, "I can't say for sure what sort of body gesture. I cannot fully recall. All I know, it was not a surrendering motion of I'm surrendering, putting my hands up or anything. I'm not sure if it was like a shoulder shrug or him pulling his pants up. I'm not sure." But, you know, there was no cross-examination in the grand jury room. And there were many witnesses who testified that Michael Brown was surrendering, that he had his hands up. And yet, when the prosecutors presented those witnesses, they did grueling, they questioned them in a very, very biting way. But these two witnesses, both of whom were questionable, especially witness number 40, were treated kind of, with kid gloves.
And McCullough, the prosecutor, either knew of this witness 40 from past acts or should have. There's an argument that she should have been screened out of this process altogether, yes?
Yes. If this website, Smoking Gun, was able to do this investigation on this McElroy in a couple of days, certainly the police department with all of its resources could have done the same, and yet they didn't do it, perhaps because they didn't want to do it. Also, there is testimony, and this is something that San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi noted in a statement about the case. Dorian Wilson, the key witness who was standing next to Brown during the encounter, provided strong testimony that called into question Wilson's claim that he was defending his life against a deranged aggressor. Johnson testified that Wilson, enraged that the young men did not obey his order to get on the sidewalk, threw his patrol car into reverse. While Wilson claimed Brown prevented him from opening his door, Johnson testified that the officer smacked him with the door after nearly hitting the pair. Johnson described the ensuing struggle as Wilson attempting to pull Brown through the car window by his neck and shirt, and Brown pulling away. Johnson never saw Brown reach for Wilson's gun or punch the officer. Johnson testified that he watched a wounded Brown partially raise his hands and say, "I don't have a gun," before being fatally shot. But the prosecutors didn't really, he testified to that, but they did not ask Wilson why he didn't attempt to drive away when Brown was allegedly reaching through his vehicle window, or to reconcile the contradiction between Wilson's claim that Brown punched the left side of his face and the documented injuries, which appear on the right side of his face. So the whole point here is not that we have to decide who's telling the truth and who isn't, but the fact that there's so much conflict in the testimony, that's precisely why a jury should have gotten this case in an open public hearing with full cross-examination and presentation of witnesses on both sides to decide whether or not the officer really was guilty or acted in self-defense.
Some defenders of this process have talked about how what's so great about the traditional grand jury process that's so one-sided. Here, all this witness, everything we've got is presented. Now, I think you sort of answered this question to some extent. Doesn't seem to be any rules of evidence and fair play that you would see in an actual trial. But And I just came upon a piece just before I called you. Kaimi Pono Wenger, who I guess also is at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, wrote a piece on the Daily Beast called We Need More Ferguson-Style Grand Juries, saying that if all these blacks and poor people who are incarcerated got a raw deal, if there was a grand jury with all this evidence, fewer of them would get to prison. Your comments on that?
Well, first of all, you're correct. There's no rules of evidence. There's no judge. If there were a judge inside the secret grand jury proceeding instead of just the prosecutor, the judge never would have allowed the prosecutor to give the grand jurors that outdated statute. I think there should be a presumption that there is a preliminary hearing, an open public preliminary hearing, to make sure that justice is done in cases of officers shooting, especially people of color. I disagree with my colleague, Professor Wenger. I think that if we had more grand juries, there would be more indictments. I mean, actually, there would be indictments. There already are a lot of indictments, but I'm not sure that just having more grand juries is going to, or having them to have all the evidence, if the prosecutor is manipulating the presentation of the evidence in the way that McCulloch did in Ferguson, nothing will change. This is really a question of prosecutors protecting the police and racism by the police, where they're overreacting because they are afraid of and dislike black people. I'm not saying all police officers do, but this is certainly the case. It was the case in the Eric Garner case. We saw it on videotape. you know, they're talking about putting video cameras on police. There was a video camera there, and we saw it with our own eyes, and yet there was no indictment in that case either. So I really think that there should be a presumption that when there's an officer shooting, especially of a person of color, that there should not be a secret grand jury. There should be an open preliminary hearing.
And as this was all developing back in August, I was struck by some comments by our good Senator McCaskill here in Missouri, as there was talk about possible bias or appearance of bias in Prosecutor McCullough. And McCaskill defended McCullough and said she supported Governor Jay Nixon's decision not to replace him with a special prosecutor. I have a unique look at this prosecutor because I have prosecuted alongside of him, McCaskill said on MSNBC. I have known him for 30 years. I know he's fair. And I remember thinking at the time, that's great that you have confidence in him, but it's not about you. And even if she was right about his fairness, and he was the most fair prosecutor in this, which personally strikes me as not having been the case, it seems like just for the appearance of conflict of interest is a good enough reason to have him step down and have a special prosecutor. And there's some petitions going around for just automatically doing special prosecutor. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's true. And when McCulloch announced the grand jury decision on national television, he sounded like a defense attorney delivering a closing argument in a jury trial, somebody defending the officer, the way he characterized the witness testimony in the light most favorable to the officer. McCulloch has a history of bias in favor of police who were involved in hassles with black men. 7,000 residents in and near Ferguson signed a petition asking McCulloch to recuse himself and get a special prosecutor, an independent prosecutor, and he refused. Let me just give you an example. McCulloch mischaracterized testimony in a case in the year 2000 where two black men were killed after officers fired 21 shots at them. And as in the Wilson case, the reasonableness of the officer's use of deadly force was critical to the self-defense claim. In the 2000 case, the officers said that the two victims were driving toward them, trying to run them down. And McCulloch claimed that all the witnesses corroborated the officer's story. But there was a later federal investigation that determined that the car was not moving forward and that only three of the 13 officers said the car was moving forward. So I would say he lied. I mean, mischaracterized is putting it nicely. And when you have this kind of a history, and his brother evidently was involved in supporting Darren Karen Wilson. There are several instances that support the conclusion that McCulloch was biased in this case in favor of the officer.
Okay. Well, I understand you have to go soon. Any final thoughts before you go about all this?
Well, the grand jury started out as a way to protect people from being railroaded by the government, but it's turned into this secret star chamber proceeding where the prosecutor holds all the cards and basically gets the grand jury to do his or her bidding. That's not the only way that a case can get to trial. As I said, an open public preliminary hearing is a far superior way. Just one last comment. In the O.J. Simpson case, started out in a grand jury, but in an almost unprecedented move, the judge disbanded the grand jury because of massive pretrial publicity and sent O.J. Simpson to a preliminary hearing. And at the preliminary hearing, which wasn't just open, it was also televised, and I did a lot of commentary for CBS and Court TV on that case. In that open preliminary hearing, Officer Mark Furman swore that he had not used the N-word in the last 10 years, and two very critical witnesses for the defense came out of the woodwork after seeing Mark Furman testify on national television at the preliminary hearing and said, yes, he had in many instances, and really turned the whole thrust of that case around. Now, regardless of what you think of the O.J. Simpson case, the point is that a preliminary hearing is open, it's public, everyone can see it, especially if it's televised, see that justice is done, there is complete cross-examination, there's a judge to rule on the evidence. It's a much more fair way to go.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it at that, but it's been fascinating. Professor Marjorie Cohn, thank you very much for coming back on Tell Somebody to talk about this.
My pleasure, Tom.
In a Reuters article posted online Tuesday, December 23, 2014, Reuters.com, the article headlined, "Off-Duty, Black Cops in New York Feel Threat from Fellow Police." Michelle Conlon writes, "From the dingy donut shops of Manhattan to the cloistered police watering holes in Brooklyn, a number of black NYPD officers say they have experienced the same racial profiling that cost Eric Garner his life." Reuters interviewed 25 African-American male officers on the NYPD, 15 of whom are retired and 10 of whom are still serving. All but one said that when off duty and out of uniform, they had been victims of racial profiling, which refers to using race or ethnicity as grounds for suspecting someone of having committed a crime. The officers said this included being pulled over for no reason, having their heads slammed against their cars, getting guns brandished in their faces, being thrown into prison vans, and experiencing stop and frisks while shopping. The majority of the officers said they had been pulled over multiple times while driving. Five had had guns pulled on them. And the article closes with this paragraph. "At an alehouse in Williamsburg, Brooklyn last week, a group of black police officers from across the city gathered for the beer and chicken wing special. They discussed how the officers involved in the Garner incident could have tried harder to talk down and upset Garner, or sprayed mace in his face, or forced him to the ground without using a chokehold. They all agreed his death was avoidable," said one officer from the 106th Precinct in Queens. "That could have been any one of us." In the time remaining, I think I'll play some more of the remarks by Georgia Walker and Kathy Kelly that I didn't have time for last week. Walker and Kelly spoke in Kansas City the night before they were convicted of criminal trespass in federal court in Jefferson City on December 10th. Georgia Walker was sentenced to 1 year of supervised probation, and Kathy Kelly was sentenced to 3 months in federal prison for trying to speak up against drone warfare operated out of Whiteman Air Force Base. Give a listen.
I want for just a moment for you to imagine this. Close your eyes and think about being in your home here in Kansas City, and those of you who live in the inner city will recognize this very well. Sitting in your living room, trying to watch TV, sitting at the dinner table, trying to have a conversation, and all of a sudden helicopters are going around and around over your house, are going up and down the streets. These helicopters, particularly in the summer when your windows are open, you hear this constant mechanical sound, and you don't know what they're looking for. You don't know whether someone's ready to burst into your room, into your home. You don't know whether they're chasing someone or what they're looking for. Well, imagine if those helicopters had Hellfire missiles on them. Imagine how you would feel not knowing, am I next? Is there somebody outside my house that looks suspicious? Is there somebody in my neighborhood walking down the street, two or three, going to another house down the block, but they look suspicious? And then all of a sudden, Hellfire missiles come raining down and hit your house in the process. Imagine what you begin to feel when this happens over and over again in your neighborhood, not knowing, am I next? That is the kind of thing that we're causing, the atmosphere we're causing for people where drones are going constantly, nonstop, making that noise overhead. And the Hellfire missile goes so fast, faster than the speed of sound, so the people who are hit by the missile don't even hear it coming. I think that's right, isn't it? There's a sound of the drone itself, but the missile, you can't hear it come. It coming, that's what I've been told anyway. That's the kind of environment that we're creating. Now, tomorrow, ironically, is International Human Rights Day. That was created after World War II, and as a matter of fact, one of the people very instrumental in moving that forward after World War II was Eleanor Roosevelt. She was our negotiator, a woman, negotiating for the United States to establish sort of a Bill of Rights, a Bill of Human Rights that would apply to people all over the world. It's like the fundamental principles of what rights do you have just because you're a human being. And one of the most important rights is the right to live. The right to live as a human being, not to have your life interrupted as we are doing. Now, that was ironical. It was actually when we were negotiating the date for the trial that's occurring tomorrow, I think it was Brian that said, oh, that's International Human Rights Day. What a perfect day to be in court and trying to exercise our rights in order to present our grievances to the state and say, not in our name anymore. We don't want this to continue to happen. There is absolutely no historical precedent for the war on terror. We have essentially said we will go anywhere we want to any sovereign nation, and we will chase down anybody we think might be a terrorist. And if we hit innocent people in the meantime, well, we're sorry, but we don't even admit it. We don't even admit that we have made a drone strike. That's another flagrant violation of all of the human rights. If we hit innocent people, they have the right to make a grievance of the government and get compensation for the damage we've caused. But we don't admit that we've dropped the missiles on them. We, for a long time, would not admit that we had drones. So far across the nation, many courtrooms won't even let you say the word drone. When you come to trial, you can't even mention that word. What we were trying to do was not trespass. We had no intent of crossing into that military base. All we wanted to do was go there in peace, with bread in our hands, ask to break bread, and ask to deliver an indictment from the people. And this indictment was to tell them that we believe what they're doing on that base is illegal and immoral, and we would like them to stop. If they had just come up to that line, taken our bread, and taken our petition, we wouldn't be in court tomorrow. But they don't do that. And the area where we were attempting to walk is an area that's passed hundreds of times every day. They only come out and exercise that line, that so-called line that we crossed, when there is a protest going on. And we didn't get very far. However, we got further than we thought we would, because there wasn't anybody there to receive anything from us. They had all retreated into the visitor center, and I guess somebody told them that we had crossed the line, and so then they came scurrying out. Because they recognized that we were nonviolent, that we were presenting no danger, that we had no intent to storm the Bastille. We were not going to try to cross over into the main military base. My particular concern with this is that I, like many of you probably, have a nephew who's been in 5 tours of duty because of the Bush and Obama wars. He's been to Iraq 3 tours. He's been to Afghanistan 2 tours. And he's getting a little wacko. I mean, I love him, but he's getting a little wacko because they keep getting him ready to go back again. And he thought Iraq was over with, and he just got orders to go back to Iraq. He thought by the end of the year that Afghanistan was over and his wife is going to be sent to Afghanistan. So their kids are going to have one parent in Iraq and one parent in Afghanistan. And at Thanksgiving he said, Why are we doing this? When is this going to end? And so it's sort of a personal as political that got me sort of wanting to know what in the world are we doing? And the more I studied it and the more I read about it, the more I got informed, I felt like we had to do something. What we did at Whiteman is being done all across the country at all the different bases. They're all, you know, solitary acts of resistance, trying to continue to express our grievance to the government. And I don't know about Kathy, but I've written to the president, I've written to the senator, my senators, to my representative, I've gone on radio shows, I've given speeches, I've written letters to the editor. No one ever answers me, but we got to keep doing that. And more people need to join us. Remember when the Vietnam War was ending, what it took. It took people in the streets. It took people demonstrating, the people saying, no more war. And right now it's so profitable to have wars that I think we're dangerously entering now the era when we can look at permanent war, because there is so much greed, there's so much profit to be made in drones and nuclear and armaments and so on. If we don't speak up, they're going to keep generating the fear. And we all know that violence never is overcome by violence. It's just a cycle of more and more and more. And so I'm encouraging you. Now, I brought a bunch of drone information, three different sets of information, one from Amnesty International, one from Code Pink, and one kind of a legal document that is legal opinions about how these wars are flagrant violations of international law. And I'll leave them up at the front. So if when you leave, if you are so inclined, pick one up or pick one of each of them up, read about it, get involved with us. You don't have to cross the line. You don't have to go to prison. But at least get your bodies out there when we go back to Whiteman, when we go back to the nuclear plant. Kathy has the real deal information about the impact on the people. So we'll hear from her next.
Thank you, Georgia, and thank you to all of you for coming tonight, to everybody who has welcomed us to come. I wonder if we could, just to make sure that whatever available chairs are here, I count three, are used. People who just came in, if you'd like to come in and sit down, that would be great.
Yeah.
Good.
So I want to especially thank Georgia for telling us about your nephew and about his spouse and about their children, because I think that's certainly a locus of where our thought can and should be when we think about whether or not we have a grievance. And I also would like to just let you know that on a few occasions people have said to me, you're completely wrong this time, because they've heard that there's a chance that this, should I be found guilty, should Georgia be found guilty tomorrow, that there's a chance a month or so later in sentencing that a judge might decide to put me, maybe because of my record, in jail for as long as 6 months. Brian Terrell is here, and we have a similar record, and Brian went before the same judge, and at the end of his sentencing hearing, he was sentenced to 6 months in prison. And so some people say, oh, you'll just be wasting your time. And I want to say, first of all, that there is a war going on here at home. We witness it when we hear the news about Ferguson. We witness it when we hear that a young man in New York was, and there's a video that shows him saying, "I can't breathe," but the chokehold continued till he died. We witness it when we recognize that in the U.S. prison system today, of all the cases of people that are charged with crimes, 3% actually go to court and somebody has an actual trial. In 97% of the cases, prosecutors use imprisonment as a weapon. They threaten, they bully, they intimidate. There are people in front of them that are defendants, and the people are so afraid. Do you know that in 2012 alone, there were an average of 5 years and 4 months as the sentence for people who took a plea. And for those who didn't take a plea, who didn't plea bargain with the prosecutor, the average length of sentence was 16 years. So those are people that are going to prison. We've got 2 million people in prison in the United States, 7 million people in the criminal justice system. I think this constitutes a war against poor people in the United States. And going into the prison industrial complex, going into the jails, is a worthwhile thing to do because it gives us a chance to speak up and speak out. But how ironic that there's such a similarity between the people that are being corralled into the jails without any kind of a trial and the people Georgia mentioned who don't get any due process, no questioning, no ifs, ands, buts. Just as a woman in Afghanistan said to me, livid really, because her son had been killed by a drone, her son who had just graduated from the police academy, her son who was sitting in the garden having tea with 4 of his friends, and they were celebrating their graduation when suddenly one of these hellfire missiles was fired by a drone and their bodies were blown apart. And the mother went to the authorities and she asked, "Why did you kill my son?" And the answer she was given was, "There were doubts. There were suspicions." Now this is a poor woman. She has no breadwinner in the home. She's not well educated, but she knew that that's no kind of an answer to give when her son had just been blown apart on a doubt, on a suspicion. I want to tell you also about Ruhullah. He came to visit us and he was very well dressed, handsome young man, starched white shirt, black suit. But as he started to tell me about what happened to his cousin, very quickly he had blotches on his neck and his face, and he started to cry. He couldn't continue. His head was in his hands. And then he started to tell the story again. And there had been a family celebration. His parents and his cousin and the cousin's parents had gone to the home of the people that his cousin had, the family they had married into, and they were having a family celebration. But then the cousin learned that the rumor was there was going to be a night raid that night in his village, and so he thought, "I'd better get back to my village, get back to my family right away." And so he hurried back, and he met another friend on the road. And as men would do in the wintertime, going through areas in the Paktika province where you could bump into wild animals, you could bump into robbers, they each had a gun. So when they got to the outskirts of their village, they saw they were really too late. There were tanks going down the streets. There were helicopters overhead. This is no time for men with guns to be out on the streets. So they turned around and they thought they'd go to a neighboring village for that night. And as they were hurrying away, they must have been identified as bad guys. And so the next day when they didn't come to their village, then the relatives and friends began to look, and finally they found the tracks of blood in the snow. And they found the bodies of those two young men. And so that was Ruhullah's story. And this can be multiplied again and again and again. And President Obama, I don't think wanting the U.S. public to know, decided before the most recent elections to extend the length of time that U.S. troops will stay in Afghanistan. And now more recently, he's also added another 1,000 troops. And we're being told, they're not going to be going into combat. This will be limited. But you see, in 21st century warfare, from what I understand, and it's not a whole lot, quite honestly, but from what I understand, they don't need big sprawling bases. They don't need huge numbers of troops. What they need are drones that can do surveillance, airborne accompaniment through drones, including weaponized drones, and combat brigade unit helicopters and other kinds of airborne vehicles to go with the Joint Special Operations warriors. These are these extremely frightening, extremely well-trained warriors, and they're now training Afghans to have the same, shall I use the word, skills in order to break into other people's houses, tear their houses apart, hog-tie the householders, lock the women in a room, tear apart the furniture, empty the cabinets, terrorize the children, and if there were to be some kind of crossfire, then even if a civilian is wounded and bleeding to death on the floor, they don't allow anybody to leave. And these are called the night raids. And of course, we're told, but our soldiers aren't going into combat. So when we think of the drones as some kind of, and again, this is a very difficult word to use, surgical strike, surgeons engage in healing people. And the exactitude that they'd like to pretend they have with these strikes is simply not truthful. The reprieve report was just issued in November of this year. And reprieve is a British group, and they were relying on the Bureau for Information and Statistics in the UK. But it's pretty remarkable. They followed from 2002 to 2014 in Yemen and in Pakistan the attacks that had been made using the drones, which were designed to be attacks that would assassinate people who had been specified as terrorists. Well, they found that it was a ratio of 28 to 1 for every one person specified as somebody who was deserving of assassination, 28 civilians were killed. The statistics are really quite remarkable because in the list that they began to compile of the people that were supposed to be assassinated, they found that the same person was assassinated not once, not twice, but three times. Well, you can only die once. And so they started to raise more and more questions. And the stats are that in Yemen, there were 17 people that they assassinated that were their targets, but 273 people altogether were killed. In Pakistan, the relationship is worse. There were 874 people killed, 142 of whom were children. And then there was the supposed effort to assassinate a man named Zawahiri, and in the many efforts to do that, 76 children were killed, 29 adults were killed, and apparently Mr. Zawahiri is still alive. Georgia and I think that reports like the Reprieve report or the most recent Amnesty International report, which I strongly encourage you to read, it was issued on August 11th, and this is a report that it's comprised of 10 case studies, and they're actually pretty ghastly and gruesome to read. I thought, well, I've read it all, but I was physically ill as I read it. And these are 10 case studies about the usage of airstrikes and drone strikes, but also the Joint Special Operations in tandem with the drones and the airstrikes, engaging in night raids and disappearances and torture. Does this do anything to ensure security for people in the United States? I mean, even General McChrystal, the former head of the International Security Assistance Forces in Afghanistan, had said very directly that the arrogance of the drone attacks actually jeopardizes security of people in the United States because the response is one of livid rage and one of more and more approval for retaliation, for fighting back. And so when President Obama tells us that the soldiers are going to go into Afghanistan, but they're not going to be part of combat, I think this is not believable, and we have to find ways to raise our voices in a challenge. And certainly we should be raising our voices in front of the legislative branch, in front of the executive branch of government, and I know that people in this room have been doing that in many creative ways your whole lives long. But it's also worthwhile to go before the judicial branch. I don't think Judge Whitworth at all sees it as his responsibility to grapple with these issues. But that doesn't mean that we can't kind of draw him further into the court of public opinion and ask ourselves all together, what issues must we raise in order, as our very dear friend Bill Quigley says, in order to narrow the gap between law and justice. In order to narrow the gap between law and justice. It's been a very hard year, a very, very hard year for our friends in Afghanistan. The situation is not getting better, as best I can tell. My young friend Raz Muhammad hasn't been able to go home and visit his family for 2 years because the roads aren't safe. The Taliban, our Italian friends who work in a hospital called the Emergency Surgical Center for Victims of War, according to them, the Taliban are controlling 70% of the country. My young friends were very, very frightened because of an extremely big battle that was happening, I think it was a week and a half ago, very close to where they live. There's so much economic futility that a UN organization reported that in the course of the past year, 4,000 Afghans tried to immolate themselves, and 4,000 more tried to poison themselves. People can't get by. There's hunger and despair and homelessness and bereavement and people being displaced. The United States military requested $58.3 billion for fiscal year 2015 for Afghanistan alone. $58.3 billion to be spent on what? Yeah. It's pretty amazing, yeah, $1 billion a week. And here we are in this country where the needs of people, many of whom have never committed any crime other than wanting to take care of their families, are not being adequately met. And so somehow if we could join with those who are saying, I can't breathe. I can't breathe in this system. And say together, we want to breathe. We want to breathe deeply. The air of freedom. We want to be able to put our hands up, praising our Lord above, praising our lucky stars because we have a good life and we have good possibilities. We don't want to be overrun by menacing militarism. It's not who we are. It's not who we want to be. It's not what we want to become for our children. So thank you very much for your attention tonight. We have many people who are good resources here, including Brian Terrell, and I'm so glad to have Buddy Bell, another Voices co-coordinator. Cassandra Dixon has driven us down here and has been many, many times over to Palestine with the Christian Peacemaker team in the past, and I see Ira Harrett and our friend Charles Carty.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody, or anytime you like, at www.tellsomebody.us.